Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow closed down 279 points. The U.S. is penalizing drug makers for charging prices that rise faster than the rate of inflation for certain people on Medicare. Pfizer tops the government's list of the first set of targeted drugs announced ahead of President Biden's speech in Las Vegas today.
After decades of trying to take on Big Pharma, we finally won.
A new study shows that kids who live in low-income neighborhoods are at 60% higher risk of developing hypertension. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Hypertension, also known as high blood pressure, is vastly underdiagnosed in children. When it begins in childhood, it can lead to organ damage and cardiovascular disease later in life. The new study looked at the medical records of more than 65,000 patients in Delaware ages 8 through 18. It found that youths who live in areas where things like housing quality and education were substandard and where unemployment levels were higher had much higher odds of developing hypertension, regardless of race or ethnicity. The only greater risk factor was a diagnosis of obesity. The findings appear in the journal JAMA Network Open. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
After years of seeing some Houston schools in low-income areas perform poorly, the Texas Education Agency says it's taking charge of the public school system. Houston Public Media's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports it's receiving bipartisan backlash.
For at least 2 years, voters in Houston won't have a say in who runs their schools. The locally elected school board members will be replaced by a group of state-appointed managers. Houston area State Representative Ron Reynolds chairs the Texas Legislative Black Caucus.
They're not accountable to the community. There's no real accountability to the parents, the students, and other stakeholders. So we're disappointed, very disappointed.
U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Houston called for a federal investigation into the takeover, describing the move as unnecessary, unfair, and discriminatory. The state education agency says the intervention will improve student performance in low-income areas. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Houston.
This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
And for KMXT, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. Kodiak's annual commercial fishing trade show, Comfish, kicks off in person and virtually tomorrow. The event brings together fishermen, lawmakers, scientists, and vendors to discuss and celebrate Alaska's fisheries. And this year's event also highlights public health. KMXT has this report. Daily forums aimed at identifying and reversing an opioid overdose are new to this year's Comfish schedule. Each forum will include CPR training and instructions on how to use the overdose-reversing drug naloxone, which is known by the brand name Narcan. Shanna Rockenbach is the Wellness Program Supervisor for the Kodiak Area Native Association and one of the organizers of the trainings. She says Comfish is another opportunity to get crucial information to more people, including many from Kodiak's commercial fishing fleet.
Maybe we'll reach one or two more people that were like adamant, no, I don't want this on my boat.
Overdose rates in Alaska from the deadly synthetic opioid fentanyl skyrocketed during the pandemic, and Kodiak was no exception. Last year, the island saw one of the largest fentanyl busts in the state, according to Alaska State Troopers. Amy Butts is a public health nurse and team lead at the Kodiak Public Health Center. She's the co-organizer of the Comfish trainings. She's been handing out Narcan as part of the state's free Narcan distribution program, Project Hope. She says getting those resources to the fishing industry is crucial.
If you have an industry that's prone to injuries, then you have opioids.
That can include prescriptions for pain, like Vicodin and Percocet. But says there's been some progress. More businesses have contacted the health center asking for Narcan or picked up emergency opioid kits. Those kits were installed in seafood processing plants across Southeast last year. Rockenbach says they hope the Comfish forums will reduce stigma and ultimately save lives.
It doesn't mean that you're allowing this to happen on your boat by carrying it. It just means that you're going to have one more tool in your toolbox to help somebody else out there.
There's two Narcan trainings scheduled each day on Thursday and Friday. Another is scheduled for Saturday morning. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. Six conservation groups filed a lawsuit against the federal government yesterday, a day after the Biden administration approved the Willow Project. That's the $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil development located in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The lawsuit claims federal agencies violated the National Environmental Policy Act by approving Willow because of its potential impacts to sensitive Arctic environments, subsistence users, and climate change. Tim Woody, spokesperson for one of the plaintiffs, the Wilderness Society, appeared on Talk of Alaska Tuesday. Woody said Willow runs counter to the administration's goal to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030.
Part of that means we don't commit to long-term massive oil and gas extraction projects that will drastically increase greenhouse gas emissions over such a long period of time.
Opponents have termed Willow a, quote, carbon bomb. The 600 million barrels of oil it's expected to produce over 30 years equates to adding 2 million cars to the road each year. Many indigenous groups remain in favor of Willow. Nagaru Kacharuk is president of Voice of the Arctic Inupiat, based in Utqiagvik. He said on Talk of Alaska he looks forward to economic benefits in the form of jobs and dividends for locals on the North Slope. Kacharuk added that he's confident the project will not threaten subsistence hunting in the area.
The subsistence and Inupiat lifestyle that we live is important. It's the most important for us. So if there was ever a project that we thought would negatively impact that in ways that would be irreparable, we would not be in support of that project.
The approved version of Willow scaled the project back from 5 drilling pads to 3 to reduce potential impacts to caribou migration and subsistence users, according to the Interior Department. Both Kacharuk and Woody expect that ConocoPhillips will begin work to ready the new pads for drilling within the next month. And Interior Secretary Deb Haaland yesterday ended the government's defense of a land exchange agreement that would have allowed the community of King Cove to build a road to reach an all-weather airport. But she committed to a new process to secure a road through Eisenbach National Wildlife Refuge. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Haaland's action starts yet another phase in the decades-long effort by the people of King Cove to get a road to Cold Bay, which they say will save lives by allowing people to fly to a hospital even when the weather is bad. Road supporters are hopeful that Haaland is sincere.
We have to believe that she is, and that's, I guess, we agreed to work with her on it.
That's King Cove Corporation CEO Della Trumbull, who has lobbied for the road for decades. Trumbull says Haaland explained her decision to local leaders with emotion in her voice. It's personal for Haaland. She's the first Indigenous Secretary of the Interior, and the people of King Cove are primarily Indigenous, too. Senator Lisa Murkowski has championed the project since her early days in Congress. She says she's not sure what to make of Haaland's pledge to help King Cove get a road, which Murkowski says was delivered, quote, with a commitment and a resolve that I had not heard before, unquote. Still, the senator remains wary.
The people of King Cove have been through so much and have been led down a road of false promises for far too long. This cannot be a false promise.
The Interior Department says it intends to initiate an environmental analysis that will, among other things, reconsider the 2013 land exchange that Sally Jewell, an Interior Secretary in the Obama administration, rejected. The Alaska Wilderness League, one of the groups suing to block the Trump administration's land exchange, praised the announcement, as did other environmental groups. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
College rankings have been in the headlines lately. Harvard and Yale recently led more than 40 law schools and a dozen of medical schools that they'll no longer send information to U.S. News and World Report for their popular yearly college ranking guide. Alaska Pacific University data analytics professor Dale Lehman has been looking closely at college graduate income data, and based on his research, he thinks choice of major matters more than the college that issues it. He explained to Alaska Public Media's Michael Finelli that he built a model to examine how much each college actually contributes to their graduates' eventual earnings.
The expected salary is one of the variables I look at, and that's simply a computation based on what fields people graduate in, what their majors were, and what we know about the different salaries of different majors. But I expanded that model beyond just what people graduate in, looked at about 20 or 25 other factors that are associated with earnings, how selective the school is, how rich the families are that the students are coming from, what their ACT scores look like. So there's a host of variables that are all associated somewhat with the earnings that people make after graduating from college.
Essentially, what you're showing is that there are a bunch of factors outside of the actual educational quality of the college that are probably stronger predictors of what someone's going to make than the educational quality of the college itself, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd say stronger, but certainly there, those factors, until you've taken into account those factors, you really can't even look at the issue of what is the college itself adding to their earnings potential, because all you're doing is observing a difference in earnings that we would expect because they took in students that were likely to end up earning more even if the college didn't do anything.
I guess generally speaking, does it seem to you that there is a strong correlation between a college's quote-unquote rank or prestige and how much a person is going to make?
Well, when I looked at that comparison of rankings, it was not very strong at all. You know, there are a few exceptions. Caltech and MIT come out easily, not just with the highest earnings, but also higher earnings than you would expect once you take into account those factors. But in many other cases, there are extreme differences. Colleges where people earn more may have, once you account for these factors, the college doesn't seem to be doing anything to contribute to the earnings.
So zooming out a little bit, I know many top law schools and medical schools have dropped out of the U.S. News and World Report rankings, which are generally considered to be kind of the gold standard, right? You didn't seem to think that their rankings were very reliable. Can you explain why you think they're flawed?
Well, I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why they're flawed. I mean, a lot of news has come out lately where the rankings have been based on faulty information, intentionally led by fed by some schools. Some schools have actually tried to manipulate the ratings by sort of improving their measures on some of the things that U.S. News uses. So there's been a lot of pushback on whether or not these rankings are at all valid or whether they're constructive.
Do you think that Alaska has competitive offerings for higher education in the marketplace?
If we just stick to earnings potential, which is all I looked at in my model, I mean, the Alaska schools don't, like I said, I think they come out pretty much where you would expect. You could look at their earnings. Some of them are fairly high and some are fairly low. But again, it can be explained. You know, if you look at UAF, they graduate a lot of STEM majors. And so you'd expect to see high earnings, and you do see fairly high earnings. Does that mean it's a good place to go to school? Is it any different than being a STEM major in California or Oregon? That takes a lot more analysis, but I have not seen Alaska stand out either in a positive or a negative way compared to schools in other states.
When you think about how closely tied choosing a major is to earnings, how would you compare that against choosing, say, the strength of a college?
My conjecture, and it's only a conjecture because it would be difficult to prove, but from what I've seen from my looking at this data, your choice of major, I think, matters more than the choice of college if the issue is how much you are likely to earn. Choosing the college can still matter, and it can still amount to a fair amount of money, but I don't think the difference between colleges varies as much as the difference between majors, at least once you take into account the factors that I looked at. So it should be a little bit of a comfort to prospective students that the earnings that they are likely to get are not really that dependent on what school they choose, but they are dependent on what major they choose.
I guess I would ask, from your personal view and knowing what you know, how would you describe the value of higher education?
It's multidimensional. It's, you acquire skills that are marketable, but more than that, the more important thing is you acquire a curiosity, a thirst for finding out more. I like to put it in terms of you learn to ask good questions. Too much of our education is based on what kind of answers you can give, when in fact the far more important skill now is to learn to ask good questions.
That was Alaska Pacific University professor Dale Lehman discussing his findings on college graduate income data with Alaska Public Media's Michael Finelli.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
Renewed concerns over banks, this time in Europe. I'm Novosava with a Marketplace Minute. The scandal-plagued Credit Suisse is in the spotlight. The bank's biggest shareholder, the Saudi National Bank, said it would not invest more money in the institution. Yesterday, Credit Suisse reported customers took out more than $120 billion during the fourth quarter of last year, and it said it found problems in its financial reporting. Investors fled European bank stocks amid renewed fears of contagion. Shares of Credit Suisse plummeted and dragged down shares of financial institutions in the UK, Germany, and France. That despite the CEO of Credit Suisse saying publicly that the bank's finances were in good shape. Some encouraging news on inflation. Wholesale prices in February retreated 0.1%. Food and energy prices fell the most. I'm Novosava with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate leasing and management. See a brighter way.
A trio of Alaska Native mushers sweep the Iditarod podium. This is coverage of the Iditarod on Alaska Public Media. I'm Casey Grove. When Ryan Reddington crossed the finish line in Nome Tuesday afternoon, he became just the sixth Alaska Native musher to win the Iditarod in the race's 50 years. The two other mushers on this year's podium that finished behind Reddington made the day even more historic. Pete Kaiser and Richie Deal are also Alaska Native. The three men say they want to show that rural Alaska mushing is not dying. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan has more.
When Pete Kaiser arrives at the finish line in Nome, he's excited despite narrowly missing out on his second Iditarod win. Part of the reason? A historic podium sweep by Alaska Native mushers in this year's Iditarod. He says it feels special.
To have three out of four in the top three is, I mean, it's almost unheard of, you know, and, aside from some of the earlier days of the race when there was more participation from rural teams and Native teams.
Just four Alaska Native mushers started this year's race. Mike Williams Jr. from Akiak is still competing. Kaiser, who lives in Bethel, and Aniak Strichy Deal, who placed third, say they hope their finishes inspire the next generation of mushers, particularly those in rural Alaska, in a year that featured the smallest field in race history. For years, dog teams off the road system in Alaska have been dwindling. But Kaiser and Deal are at the forefront of a small but meaningful resurgence of rural mushing. They live in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, one of the few rural hotspots where major competitive dog races still take place, like the Kuskokwim 300. Deal says the community in the YK Delta has been exceptionally supportive, which allows mushers like himself to maintain their kennels.
There's a lot there to it, but I think it shows that in some parts of Alaska, in rural Alaska, that mushing isn't dying.
Reddington, Kaiser, and Deal consider themselves friends, but competition was fierce in the final 300 miles of trail. The three teams ran at a similar pace in the first half of the race, near the front of the field. Then Reddington, whose mother is a Nupiak from Unalakleet, surged ahead with two monster runs. Kaiser opted for longer rest instead at one of the final checkpoints. He says he knew his decision might let Reddington slip away, but his team needed a break between Koyuk and White Mountain.
You know, some years you can do that run if they're set up for it. Other years, Other years you can't, so.
Kaiser says he felt that Reddington was particularly motivated for the win this year.
I knew he'd be real tough to beat coming up the coast. I knew he had a lot of motivation and determination to get it done. And we did too, but, you know, there can only be one winner, so.
Phil, he says they were all friendly at checkpoints, trading stories and tips.
You know, we're competitors, but we're a small-knit group, and we kind of all know each other pretty well. And, yeah, it'd be a long day out there if you weren't friends with anybody.
Kaiser says while he was hoping for a win, notching a strong showing for rural and Alaska Native mushers was special.
I think it's great, maybe, you know, maybe hopefully inspiring to another generation of kids in the villages and in rural Alaska or anywhere, you know, to, you know, take on a crazy sport like this.
All three mushers say they'll keep competing and motivating young mushers, but first they say they'll need a nap. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lex Trinan.
Eddie Burke Jr. of Nenana appears to have claimed Rookie of the Year honors in the 2023 Iditarod, finishing in seventh place late Tuesday. Friends and family greeted him. Several wore custom sweatshirts with a silhouette of Burke's face and his characteristic long curly hair. Burke says it was a hard-fought battle with Hunter Keefe, who he ran close to for much of the race, and he says it was a fun competition.
Him and I both were just having a good time, but of course, I know he wants Rookie of the Year just as much as I do, and it was fun battling it out. And I don't know, I got to know the guy pretty well through the experience, so that was cool as well.
A former garbage truck driver and amateur boxer, Burke has only been competing in sled dog races for 2 years, but already has an impressive resume. That includes a victory in the competitive Knick 200 earlier this year. And his hopes for winning Rookie of the Year honors in the Iditarod were almost derailed when he fell off his sled on a stretch of trail on the Yukon River in sub-zero temperatures. Burke got a couple rides, including from two of his competitors, while his team continued down the trail. He met the dogs at the next checkpoint.
I'd say they were a little confused, but they were all healthy and okay.
Burke says he learned his lesson to tie himself to his sled if he's going to sleep on runs. This concludes our morning Iditarod coverage. You can find more at alaskapublic.org, including photos and more stories. I'm Casey Grove. Thanks for listening, and this is Iditarod coverage on Alaska Public Media.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Well, good afternoon. The day is Wednesday, March 15th. The year is 2023. Sunrise today was at 8:25 a.m. Sunset tonight will be at 8:12 p.m. That gives us just shy of 12 hours of daylight, 11 hours and 47 minutes. Sunrise tomorrow is at 8:22 a.m. That's a gain for today of 5 minutes and 1 second of daylight. Record high for today was 49 degrees back in 1967 and then again in 1968. Record low was just before that, negative 1 degree in 1966. Looking over at our marine weather from Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles today, there's a small craft advisory. North winds of 25 knots, diminishing to 15 knots in the afternoon, seas to 6 feet, freezing spray in the morning. Tonight, northwest winds of 20 knots with seas to 5 feet. Looking over at the Shelikof, there's a small craft advisory through Thursday. Today, north winds of 25 knots, seas to 8 feet with freezing spray and snow showers. Tonight, north winds of 25 knots, seas to 8 feet with freezing spray and snow showers. Have some time for some community announcements. There is a Kodiak Island Borough Assembly and School District Board joint work session. That's Thursday, March 23rd at 6:30 p.m. Joint work sessions are informal meetings of the Borough Assembly and School Board, although additional items not listed on the joint work session agenda are sometimes discussed when introduced by elected officials, staff, or members of the public. No formal action is taken at joint work sessions, and items that require formal action are placed on a regular borough assembly and or school board meeting agenda. You can call in for that. That's 907-486-7599 for that call-in number on Thursday, March 23rd at 6:30. And Kodiak Arts Kodiak Arts Council Arts and Adventure Auction is coming up. They invite the public to join them for food, wine, art appreciation, and bidding for a cause. The Kodiak Art Council's 32nd Annual Arts and Adventure Auction will be held on Saturday, April 1st at the Afognak Center on Near Island. Doors to the auction open at 6 p.m. and the live action starts at 7 p.m. All proceeds from the auction support the Art Council's mission to create opportunities for the people of Kodiak to experience and participate in the arts. Donations of artwork are accepted year-round. For more information, you can call the Arts Council at 942-5840 or through email at kodiakartscouncil@gmail.com. And join the Choose Respect initiative to encourage the formation of healthy, respectful relationships and promote a culture of no tolerance for domestic and sexual violence. You can help share the message of hope and healing. That's with the Kodiak Stands Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. That's on March 22nd at 12 p.m. It begins and ends at the Shunack Tribal Hall. That's through the Kodiak Women's Resource Center. And notice is hereby given, there will be a Board of Education regular meeting on March 20th at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room, F140 of the Old High School Wing. For more information, contact Trinity, Secretary to the Board of Education, at 486-7566. And Island Trails Network is collecting submissions for their 13th annual Kodiak Outdoor Film Festival. That's going to be on Friday, April 7th. The deadline to submit your entries is coming up March 31st, so get out and start filming your adventures. You can visit islandtrails.org/film for guidelines. And one last one, the Kodiak Refuge Salmon Camp Registration Lottery is open. The Kodiak Refuge will be having summer science camps for students going into kindergarten through eighth grade. Find registration packets on the Kodiak Refuge website or stop by the Refuge Visitor Center. Packets are available at the front door or inside during open hours. That's Wednesday through Friday from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Deadline to enter the lottery is also coming up March 31st.
It's a tough time, but each of us can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. All you have to do is give via Pick, Click, Give by supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD. You aren't just donating. You're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. You're changing the lives of Alaskans with the click of a button. Don't forget to Pick, Click, Give when you fill out your PFD application this year.